think of any well-known artist or world-known celebrity, and chances are my next guest has photographed them. Annie Leibovitz's powerful portraits have appeared for four decades on the covers and insides of magazines like Rolling Stone, Vogue, and others. While she's best known for her celebrity photographs, Annie Leibovitz works just as well from a war zone, an Olympic venue, or a courtroom. Her work establishes her as an astute observer of American culture. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines and photos of Annie Leibovitz, one of the most celebrated, if not the most celebrated, photographer today. Her latest book is Annie Leibovitz at Work. Leibovitz has six previous books, and her work has appeared in museums and galleries all over the world, including the National Portrait Gallery. She's been designated as a living legend by the Library of Congress. It's always a delight to welcome a legend. Thank you so much, Annie, for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
Well, it's great to see you again, Valerie. Great.
Well, this book is another great one. In the beginning of this new book, you said you had been accustomed to looking at the world through a frame. What frame did you mean?
I mean, the book, of course, is geared towards a young photographer, someone who might be interested in getting into photography and might want to do something like what I'm doing. So when I talk about the frame, I went to school at the San Francisco Art Institute and was taught personal reportage. And I was taught to actually look through the camera and frame with the rectangle of the camera, with a 35-millimeter camera, which was the camera of choice at that time. And so it really literally means looking through the camera, or if you don't have the camera there, you're basically placing people and places and landscape into rectangles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now I am putting you in a rectangle, you know, and I'm moving around. My eye is sort of trained, you know, after, you know, all these years, just to always see, you know, how something can be framed.
You talked a little bit about when you were growing up and the driving that you had to do with your family when they would move from one military base to another. You mentioned a frame back then.
My older sister thought about this and was the first to say it, that we couldn't afford hotels, and my father being in the military, we were stationed every couple of years, you know, Fairbanks, Alaska. Imagine driving from Fairbanks, Alaska down to Fort Worth, Texas, and, you know, five or six kids thrown in the back of the station wagon. And all of us on top of each other. And I guess what my sister was trying to say is that, you know, my first frame really was looking through the car window. It was really a kind of a great way to grow up. I mean, a lot of people, you know, may think otherwise, but being it really brought our family together, and my brothers and sisters were my best friends. And
did that military lifestyle directly influence your interest in photography?
Well, I think I'm a master of the 15-minute relationship. You know, you know, I think it does. It has a lot of parallels. You know, like you go in and you go out. You know, it's like, so I think there is a lot of it's very, very similar. When I think back on it now, of course, you look at everything from the other side looking back now, and it does seem that way. Yes.
Well, after you were a fine arts student and took some courses in photography, you decided to go with photography as opposed to painting because you said it suited you more. How was that? What was more suitable about photography than painting?
You know, I went straight from high school to the Art Institute, and I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, and I was a painting major. And, you know, it was the end of the Vietnam War. It was the end of Love and Peace, and wasn't exactly a pretty time, and the painting rooms were filled with abstract expressionists, and they were all angry. You know, they seemed like they were slashing on their canvases, and you know, to be a young kid in that, I wasn't ready for isolation, and I wasn't ready certainly to be abstract. I really wanted reality, and I remember sort of you know, after I spent the summer with my family. My father was stationed at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and I bought a camera and I went back to school. I took a night class in photography, and you know, the photography department was in the basement of the Art Institute, and it was kind of a very social place. People, you know, it seemed like they were talking to each other, first of all, and then And then the camera itself, I mean, you know, when you're young, you're not, you're unformed. You know, the camera socialized me. It took me out. And, you know, I still believe it's a nice, wonderful way to enter the world. For a young photographer to have a camera, and that cliche of it, it's your friend, you know, that you can go out and give you a purpose. I think it's very sweet. It's very nice.
I like what you said about the camera gives you license to do things you might not otherwise do.
Absolutely. It made me more brazen. It made me it made me feel like I had a license to go places that, you know, I think you normally wouldn't go by yourself. And certainly those early years at Rolling Stone really, you know, set me up in such a beautiful way. I wish young people beginning could have this feeling of what they do matters, you know, that they need to find someone or somehow or some structure that lets them know that what they do matters. And I was very lucky those early years at Rolling Stone, and it sort of has stayed with me.
Let's talk about Rolling Stone for a moment and some of the things that you've learned from the magazines that you've worked with. You said that you found concert work difficult at first. Why was that?
Well, I have to realize going to the San Francisco Art Institute, I went as a – it was a fine art photography program, and my the people that I – learned about were like Robert Frank and Cartier-Bresson. So I was not a music photographer. I was not a, you know, I didn't know a thing about rock and roll. What I knew about was photography and taking kind of personalized kind of pictures. So actually doing concerts are believe it or not, it's more technical. It's you have to be in the right place at the right time, and you have to follow, you need to see at least three concerts to really kind of know what is going on and what's going to happen. And then, you know, in those days, in those early days, you were at the mercy of the lighting people who God knows what they were on, and the lights would go up and down and in and out. It's funny, I think about it now, and I think I should have just kept it at one f-stop and one shutter speed the whole time, because I would have gotten more pictures than having every time I changed the, you know, the aperture, you know, every time they changed the light. I mean, it was definitely a little crazy then.
You said that back then you thought that the way to get good pictures was to become one of the guys, in the environment, so to speak. That time, but you said that kind of somehow took you over this
that's
whole
right. it
lifestyle.
Was, it wasn't so smart. It wasn't so smart. I mean, it's I think when you're young, you are one is obsessive about what they're doing, which is not a bad thing. But I think that, and I thought that as a young photographer, that in order to get the best pictures, you had to really become one with what you were doing.
You know? So what kept you grounded in spite of all those temptations and whatnot? Because obviously you came back to earth, or you wouldn't have been.
Well, it took me about 8 years to come. My friends would say, "You're still on the tour, Annie. Would you get off the tour?" No, I mean it. What I meant is, it was an example of holding on to a piece of yourself. Don't you know, to a young photographer, don't give everything you have away.
Right.
Hold on to a piece of yourself. And I think I credit really the camera saving me in the long run. You know, by still having the camera on my side, it kept me
interesting.
It kept me, you know, centered. But you know, when I finally edited all those pictures, you know, years later, and I look back, and I wanted to make it look like what it was. It was hard because the more I sort of made it look like what it was, it seemed to me it came across even more romantic.
You mentioned editing just now. I remember in the book that you said one of the things you learned from working at Rolling Stone was that you learned to edit yourself. Who was it that first told you to edit your work and be involved in how it's used? Was that
It was B.F. Feidler, who was a very important art director. She was from the Brodovich School of Design. She and Ruth Ansel art directed Harper's Bazaar for 11 years. They were sort of these glory years that everyone remembers. You know, Richard Avedon was shooting Hero, Irving Penn, just extraordinary visually. Harper's Bazaar in Vogue, and we were very, very lucky. I discovered her, or she discovered me. Actually, she was the art director of Ms. Magazine. And she was working in New York, and I was on the West Coast, and you know, working at Rolling Stone. And she thought I was some older lady or something. And then she met me, and I was like 20 or 21 or something. And she was so sort of surprised, and she started asking me to do work, you know, for Ms. Magazine. And then Jan Winter brought her out to do some work on Rolling Stone. But I was so lucky to have such a brilliant art director who sort of you know, inspire me and tell me a bit about the ropes. And we miss that now. I miss that now, these mentors, these art directors that helped bring people along and were not afraid of failures.
They're not out there anymore?
Not really. Not really. It's really a vacuum. There really are not. I think also with the economy, there's a fear of, you know, it's hard for a young person to get started because in the magazines, because they like to stay with what they know. I mean, there's not someone bringing along young talent like the way there should be. Someone should do something about that, for sure.
Let's talk about Vanity Fair. Tina Brown said that you were a Barbara Streisand with a camera. Do you know what she meant by
Valerie,
that?
I think Graydon might have said that.
Oh, I'm
Did he
sorry.
Say that? I'm not too sure.
Okay. What was it meant by that, that you were a Barbara Streisand with a camera?
Well, I guess it could mean that I could be, to some people, I've heard that I'm difficult, you know, that I can be difficult. And you know, I run a tight ship and I have, you know, I think it took me many years to learn how to work with the people I work with. And now I have, you know, people who work for me and they've worked for me for many years now. And it's very nice people. Actually, when I became pregnant with Sarah, they just sort of, you know, held me up. You know, they really... You know, they made my work. They made it possible for me to continue my work, and they're a very special group of people that I work with. But in any case, I can be a terror. You know, I mean, because I keep telling some people I work with that, you know, when I'm not working, I'm, you know, I'll be nice again. You know, but when I'm working, it's.
Well, you're working.
You're working, exactly.
Right. Well, at Vanity Fair, you started was that where you first started using multiple frames when you were shooting these large groups of people?
You know, I first noticed it with Hockney, David Hockney. He started to do this collage work where he opened up the whole frame. And I remember just being sort of weak in the knees and looking at that work that he did, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this is really how the eye sees. This is kind of amazing. And it just coincided with the fact that I started to do these Vanity Fair covers that were, you know, maybe three panels wide. And I remember I did a group shot. It was almost a takeoff on the MGM group shot with all these great actors. And it was like probably some of the last pictures ever taken, you know, like Ginger Rogers and Gene Autry. And it was this amazing group. And I used a camera that distorted on the sides. And it broke my heart. It just broke my heart because I was trying to use a camera that had a big enough negative or big enough lens. Right. It broke my heart. And I started to take my regular camera, the Mamiya at the time, with a normal lens and just pan it. And so I could use a normal lens and just, I would just go left, middle, right. And I started to put those pieces together, and everything started to fall together, and it was sort of beautiful. And I did this for years, where I was shooting even my regular frames, my regular photographs with two frames. I would go a little to the left and a little to the right, and I thought, oh, this is interesting because you're seeing a little more on either side.
Well, now that everything is digital, though, is that less work, or is it about the same?
Less work is less. It's not really... It looks like less work, but it's actually, I feel like on some levels it's brought out more work. It's digital's amazing, but it has been a real, you know, learning time. Like everyone else who's learning digital, I'm learning digital too. So I'm just learning it in front of everybody. And but I find it so thrilling, so exciting. You know, first of all, you can shoot in very little light, and I'm interested in that. And you can shoot fat. You can shoot multiple images, you know, some cameras now you can do 9 frames a second, and that's kind of interesting. So there's lots of new interesting ways to use this digital. But to begin with, I was a mess with it. But I have it sort of back now to where when I'm actually shooting, I'm not tethered to a computer or anything. I'm shooting almost like the way I was shooting film. Like I don't stop so much and look at
the
back. I try to just shoot. And then afterwards, I sit down and torture myself and everyone else working with me, trying to put this stuff together and do outputs. But it's all learning, a learning curve.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going Between the Lines with award-winning photographer Annie Leibovitz. We're talking about her latest book, Annie Leibovitz at Work. In 2004, the American Society of Magazine Editors named Leibovitz's portrait of John Lennon with Yoko, taken just hours before his death, and appeared on the cover of Rolling Stone. They named it the best magazine cover of the last 40 years. And just in case there was any doubt about Annie's ranking, she also was number two on the same list, with her portrait of the nude and very pregnant Demi Moore on the cover of Vanity Fair. These cover shots, you said, were very much like advertising and the work that you might have done with American Express and whatnot. You originally resisted doing advertising work. What changed your mind, and how did you basically kind of...
Yeah, Val, I'm going to separate those two pictures a little bit. I think okay. John and Yoko, I at that point with with Rolling Stone, I was there wasn't too much difference. I didn't feel that it was getting to that point of advertising. In fact, I was in the height of my conceptual
in the Rolling Stones area.
The John and Yoko mm-hmm. fits into the height of that conceptual work. I would have loved to continue to have done that, but believe it or not, that conceptual work when Rolling Stone moved to New York, Jan Winter started testing the covers, and the Steve Martin picture against the Franz Kline painting, which was a cover for Rolling Stone. It was their worst selling issue they ever
had. Is that right?
Because he was so small, he was so diminished. So they started
This is a portrait right. of him in a white suit against right. a huge painting of
Franz
white
Kline,
with the black swatches and the swipes of black paint.
And the paint is sort of slashed across
his suit,
white
tux, making him a part of the painting.
Sort of a Fred Astaire. So, even Jan Winter, when we moved to New York, wanted to change the covers to being, large heads against white. Wanted to do a simple cover with a recognizable person. And Life magazine was even at that point in the late 70s. Well, actually, it was gone at that point. But they came back for a few years, and they started testing. They were testing their covers, which I thought was the beginning of the end. As far as the conceptual cover was concerned. And, so when I talk about the Demi Moore picture, it was a very important cover of a magazine, but if it was a picture, I probably would not have had her covering her breast or, wearing that diamond ring or, it would have been a little bit more...
If it had been more of a portrait, it would have been...
Right.
A cover for a magazine.
Right. So that's where I had to start separating it. And I didn't mean to hurt the picture at all, but I just wanted to be clear that that was a cover.
Right.
I don't even want to do the covers, really, because it's sort of a thankless job. There's a little complaining about magazine work in the book, and then I talk about how much I love doing the books because it's so pure. But when you work for magazines, it's important to realize that, all right, I'm probably telling myself this, that you're working with editors and art directors, and there are lots of agendas there that you're working with people.
I have another technical question. In talking about your shoot in your book with Arnold Schwarzenegger with his horse, mm-hmm. he had this beautiful white horse, and he wanted to be photographed with him.
That was his horse, Val.
Yeah, I know.
He brought it along
right,
to the shoot.
Right.
He said, I have this horse. I said, okay, so fine, bring it. I was so surprised, though, when I saw it,
And then he was in a pair of white riding pants on this white horse, right?
Mm.
You said that initially you weren't sure if you liked the photo because it was primarily about form, that you were reluctant to have form impose the meaning on a picture. Explain that to me.
Well, it's a good question. I did the 1996 Olympics here,
right.
for Atlanta, the Summer Olympics, and I felt the pictures were very beautiful, but they had a lot of form, and they were kind of very reminiscent of Leni Riefenstahl even, but it didn't carry it over the top for me. It was like they were beautiful, they were handsome, they were graphic, But I didn't feel like it gave you much else. It didn't tell you about, you know, what it took to get there,
yeah.
you know, and or it didn't give you anything more. And I was worried about that Arnold picture, you know, just having those same kinds of, no idea really other than the form. And,
right.
you know, I always know I can fall back on graphics and composition. But that's not enough for me. I like it to have something more. So I was always worried about that picture, but I think in a certain respect, after time, I've grown to like that picture
yes.
because I think that form works for Arnold.
It does. It does. You once said, when I take a picture, I take 10% of what I see. How do you adjust for the other 90%?
No, it's
frustrating. Is it even possible?
No, you cry all the time. You can't get it all. I think photography is limited. You're only going to get, maybe if Valerie, if I moved in with you and we spent a year together, I would probably get everything I needed to get. But you know, you can't. You're just there for a second. You're just seeing a brief moment of someone's life, and you know, in the day to day work. And then this always happens where I'm seeing like two or three things going on at once. And you also have to make up your mind when it's appropriate to shoot or not shoot, or you can't constantly be shooting all the time because it would drive, you know, anyone, you know, nuts. You know.
Well, you know, over the years I've learned, because I have a lot of musicians in my family, I've learned how to technically listen to music, the movements, its changes, the melody, tempo, rhythm, so forth. Mm. But how does one learn how to look at or see a photograph if you are supposed to be critiquing it? Should it even be analyzed, or should it be just an emotional response?
You need to do it and keep doing it, and you need to looking at it. I remember when I was young and I was first starting, I really didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't tell you what I was doing. And I think it's over years of doing it and starting to look back at your work. I see so many people, so many photographers, they don't go back often enough to look at what they've done, to sort of know what to do next or what they have done. They just keep going. And you know, it was funny because I've just recently been asked, well, what about all the iPhone cameras and what's the difference between, you know, that? And I mean, I love that everyone is photographing on the iPhone is or on their phones. Or I think that it replaces the Kodak Brownie, so that we have these moments and these memories that we keep. But I think probably what sets, the photographer aside from these day-to-day, you know, pictures are looking back at it and accumulating it and editing it and understanding what you have and presenting it.
You know? Well, you said you learned so much from your 1991 retrospective.
Absolutely. It was so important. And Bea Feiler, and you know, insisted that if you wanted to learn, the way to learn was to look back.
Well, even though your work is so immediately recognizable to many, still it can be very diverse. Is that in and of itself a style, this repertoire of
thank you. Approaches. I appreciate you saying that. But you know, now doing this for 40 years, I mean, I sometimes feel like a conceptual artist using photography. You know, I mean, it's has so much latitude, so many possibilities. And the book sort of takes you through these building blocks of photographs that sort of built the work. But also, I was sort of finding my way and trying to use photography in every single way you could use it. And mm-hmm. You know, I'm a huge fan of photography. I love photography. I love all the photography books that come out. I love portrait. I love journalism. I love, you know, and now, Thomas Struth and Nan Golden and Lynn Davis. I'm a huge fan. I love to look at it. So I feel it's just wonderful to be able to, you know, sort of pull together this palette or this or this vocabulary of ways to work, and then the work is really deciding how you want to approach each subject.
Your approach to nudes is very interesting because I don't think I've seen any of your nudes that has a head or a face. Is that is that right? I mean, why this approach?
No, you're so smart. That's very good. You know, I think I was when I did that set of pictures of dancers for, you know, for the Pirelli calendar, I was looking at a lot of classic nudes, and I was reluctant to put a personality, you know, on the nude. I was afraid it would take it to another place, and I wanted to do it as pretty much as an exercise of a study of the body, almost like a life study, because there was no sexuality involved in it, and then no no personalization of it other than just a love for the body, you know, the beautiful body. And it was so interesting working with dancers, because even when they're lying there and staying still, they're still moving. You know, it's actually a very interesting exercise.
One of the things that you mentioned to young photographers is that what you learned is that you don't really need all of that equipment. Is that still true?
I think it's great and it's important if you want to get to this place where you have this huge vocabulary of different ways to work. To learn how to light and learn how to use your equipment. But the reality is content is so important. And there's a little chapter in the back of the book called Being There. Mm-hmm. And it's about, listen, after all is said and done, you know, it's not about the equipment. You know, my cameras don't have names. It's not about the lights. It's what you're seeing and the content in the picture. And, you know, John and Yoko, I mean, it could have been black and white, or it could have been color, or it could have been purple, you know, I mean, it's like the content and the form, you know, like carries it through. So it's so important to, on occasion, for me to leave my assistants and leave my lights behind. And actually, in photographer's life, that's what was so wonderful for me, is I sort of came clean and you saw that other work, you know, I've never stopped doing the simple, you know, personal reportage. It's always been there. So
for our young photographers, could you finish this sentence, please? The most important thing a young photographer can do is to learn how to
see. You know, you're not going to get every picture. You can't. You have to sometimes be there, and you're not going to take a picture. And I remember Robert Frank told me, you're not going to get every picture. I mean, that was actually very comforting. I mean, you want to get every picture, but you can't. And sometimes, and I'm with my children, for example, I find myself, even though I see the pictures all the time, I find myself just wanting to be there.
Yes. I've so enjoyed this. Thank you so much, Annie Leibovitz, for being with me today.
You were great, Valerie.
Thank you. Annie Leibovitz's latest book is Annie Leibovitz at Work.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of WABE Atlanta.